Did you know there's an online cannabis company that ships federally legal THC right to your door? And they found a way to combine THC with carefully selected functional ingredients to create gummies, baked goods, and flower for whatever type of buzz you'd want. I'm talking about Mood.com. They have an incredible line of cannabis gummies, and you get 20% off your first order at Mood.com with promo code SPECIALISTS with an S on the end. This isn't some rinky-dink discount of 5 or 10%. This is 20% off your first order. Forget one-size-fits-all supplements that only get you high. Mood's functional gummies are optimized to kick in as little as 15 minutes and take you to the mood you're looking for. My favorite are the Sleepy Time Advanced gummies. That's right, those are for sleepy time. You know when you just can't fall asleep? Take these and they'll put you right in the mood. Beyond gummies, Mood also has a selection of flower, pre-rolls, bakery treats, and beverages. Listen, you can find gummies to just get you high pretty much everywhere these days. But Mood's functional gummies combine premium, federally legal THC with targeted botanicals to help you get into the perfect mood, usually in as little as 15 minutes. And everything ships discreetly right to your door. No dispensary lines, no awkward conversations, just better days and nights delivered to your doorstep. Best of all, not only is every Mood product backed by a 100-day satisfaction guarantee, but as I mentioned, listeners get 20% off their first order with promo code SPECIALISTS with an S on the end. So head to Mood.com, find the functional gummy that matches exactly what you're looking for, and let Mood help you discover your perfect mood. And don't forget to use promo code SPECIALISTS when you check out to save 20% on your first order. Try it today at mood.com.
Movie Buff Specialist Phil and John are back, and we continue counting down our favorite 100 movies of all time, all the way up to number 23, episode number 78 coming your way right now. John, we're ripping on through, even though it's been like 2 weeks since our last episode. It's still crazy to think we're all the way down to number 23. Talking L.A. Confidential for me from 1997, Zodiac for John from 2007. Two movies that just certainly are what they are. It'll be fun to talk about these two side by side because one is a film noir that is very much a film noir, and one is an investigation film that is very much an investigation film. Like, these are two movies that do not pull any punches. So it's fun to watch these together and look at how they kind of just went for the genre or the realism as much as they possibly could. John, this was your first time watching LA Confidential?
It was, yeah. It's one that's just kind of been on my list for a while and then faded for even longer of a while. And then eventually I got around to it. And it's quite good.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm glad you enjoyed it. Yeah. Of course, John hasn't seen one of my movies. It's like it's become the norm. But
it's okay. We're getting to the point where you haven't seen my movies. So
I saw Zodiac.
Yeah, but I mean, we're getting there.
We're getting there.
More of my
we're getting
movies
there.
Coming up you haven't seen.
Let's see. Next week, I've seen your movie, you know, seen your movie the week after that. Maybe I haven't seen End of Evangelion. Maybe. But anyway. All right. So talking LA Confidential, we're talking Zodiac. These are two movies. Very interesting. Now, LA Confidential is 25 years old. Zodiac is 15 years old. Two movies that came out during very, very, very busy years. Zodiac came out the year with There Will Be Blood, Atonement, No Country for Old Men. What were like the blockbusters of 2007? What am I missing that came out that year?
It's tough because those are the movies that you mentioned are the ones that I always remember coming out that year.
Spider-Man 3 was that year, Shrek the Third. So yeah. That tells you those types of movies. But Bourne Ultimatum, Ratatouille came out that year. That's a lot. I mean, 2007, that was when Die Hard got rebooted, American Gangster, like super bad, really crowded year.
Yeah.
And as Fincher often does, this movie didn't make that much money. 1997 is the year Titanic breaks all the box office records, and Good Will Hunting and Boogie Nights also come out that year, which are two very popular movies. LA Confidential kind of gets pushed a little bit to the wayside. So we're talking about two like hidden gems here that shouldn't be hidden gems. Like these should be forefront viewing for movie fans and for people in general. And yet they are hidden gems. We're going to start with Zodiac because I personally believe it's less popular than LA Confidential, and I'll never ever be convinced otherwise, even though, man, Zodiac, maybe the most underrated movie of the 2000s.
It's very possible. Zodiac has for a very long time been that movie everyone kind of forgets David Fincher. When people talk about Fincher, they'll talk about either Seven or The Social Network or Fight Club. Like, those are the three that everyone really talks about. And Zodiac kind of just faded into obscurity. Part of it does come from the fact that it came out in 2007, which is a year where, despite how phenomenal the performances are in this movie, not a single one of them had a chance of being nominated for Oscars because of how crowded that year was. It almost feels like this movie was a little ahead of its time. Mm-hmm. It hit about 5 years before the true crime craze kind of started. So it wasn't really what people were expecting. It's a heavy film on a subject mm-hmm. matter that's a little too real sometimes. But this is peak Fincher. I mean, I do have a Fincher movie higher than this, but I hands down think this is Fincher's second best movie. And it's by quite a margin.
Yeah, I mean, we both have the same number one for Fincher, which is The Social Network. We both have that as his best movie. I mean, I think that's a masterpiece that should have won Best Picture and all that fun stuff. Even if I do have, you know, Blue Valentine coming up next week, which came out the same year as The Social Network. But you know what I mean? When you look at what was actually nominated, I think that The Social Network should have won. The interesting thing with David Fincher is, despite how popular Fincher is, his movies aren't really box office successes ever, ever.
No.
The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo is an infamous disaster. And it's a great movie, but it's an infamous disaster. You have Gone Girl, which made a pretty good amount of money and like was probably his most popular. He followed up with Mank, which if it wasn't on Netflix, nobody would have watched that movie.
Yeah.
Fight Club was a cult hit. Nobody saw The Game. Seven kind of made a lot of money, and then Panic Room just kind of was Panic Room. Curious Case of Benjamin Button, coming on the heels of Zodiac, lived off the hype of Zodiac to make some money. But The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, in my opinion, is the worst David Fincher movie. I hate The Curious Case of Benjamin Button. The only part of that movie I like is when they go through all the things that happen right before Cate Blanchett gets hit by the car. It's the only part of that movie that I think is worth watching. I think the rest of it is just nonsense. But Zodiac shows such a command. Okay. So we talked about Spotlight earlier in this series, and you had it in your top 100, and I probably don't have it in my top 10,000. But Spotlight gets so much credit because it's like, well, it's reporters figuring it out. Cool. Hold my beer and watch Zodiac. Yeah. Because Zodiac is that to the nth degree. Zodiac is the interesting version of that. And I know I'm ripping a movie that's in your top 100, but what I'm saying is Zodiac takes a really interesting subject matter and makes it really interesting the whole time without Hollywoodizing it. It gets so close to Hollywoodizing it so many different times, but it never does. It's just so matter of fact. All of the characters don't really have redemptive arcs. Robert Downey Jr. is an alcoholic. Mark Ruffalo is just the obsessed cop who kind of crooked, not really crooked, whatever. And then you have Jake Gyllenhaal who is just obsessed.
Yeah.
And it doesn't give you really, like, you're rooting for Jake Gyllenhaal for the most part, and obviously you're rooting against the killer, but it just lets it unfold in the most real way it can. To make a 2-hour and 40-minute movie that unfolds like that. But I agree with you 100%. I think this was ahead of its time. People love true crime. If this came out in the era of Netflix, and you have to think, what, didn't Fincher make a Zodiac Killer like series or so? Didn't they make a Zodiac series?
He did that Mindhunter series, didn't he?
Mindhunter, that's what it was. If this came out in the era of Netflix, this would have been unbelievably popular and probably would have been in contention for Best Picture that year. It really would have, because No Country and There Will Be Blood wouldn't have built up the same type of, oh my God, did you see Zodiac? Yeah. But the problem in 2007 was hey, did you see Zodiac? And everybody went, no. And that was it. That was the end of the story. And that's why this movie didn't get the love that it really deserves. And it's forgotten now. I mean, it's 15 years old. It's got all these A-listers in it. I mean, it is loaded from top to bottom. And yet, that's it. Like, it doesn't get that recognition.
It doesn't. And it does have its cult following. It does have... it's
as most Fincher
movies people who as most Fincher movies do, but like this one I think has a very fervent cult following who really dig in with how well made this film is. Mm-hmm. And it's funny you were saying like 2007 was just kind of that year no one saw this movie. I specifically remember in 2007 being like, I'm going to go see this movie in theaters. I saw a different movie instead that I'm not going to mention here because it was a much worse movie.
What was it?
No, I said I'm not going to mention it, Phil.
Okay, but is it I Am Legend?
No.
That's no. That's a bad movie.
It is. But the point of the matter being, like, I went with a group of friends and a couple of us were really into film. We're like, let's go see Zodiac. And everyone else is like, no, that seems terrible. And wow, I fell on the right side of that history because this movie is just incredible. It does have all these A-listers, but it has these A-listers at a time where they weren't A-listers yet.
Yeah.
Right? This was right before Jake Gyllenhaal really took the plunge as like this big A-lister in these like dark, gritty movies.
And immediately before Robert Downey Jr.'s rebirth of his career.
Exactly. It was 2007. This is the year before Iron Man. Right.
Yeah. This joke in this movie when it came out was like, oh, Robert Downey Jr. is just playing himself because Robert Downey Jr. just gone through everything.
Yeah, exactly. And then you have Mark Ruffalo, who, again, also going to be huge once he enters the Marvel Cinematic Universe in 2012. Like, these were actors who at the time were just trying to find something to do. And David Fincher took them and pulled out these magnificent performances from them. Jake Gyllenhaal goes all in on the obsession in this film.
Yeah.
Every single moment, you can see how much this is just building around him. And the way his character is framed in this movie, Fincher does a fantastic job to set it up of like you thinking, wait, is he the Zodiac killer? Because he's so obsessed with it all and he knows everything, right? You get that scene where the first cipher comes in and he's like, his name's in there. And Robert Downey Jr.'s character is just like, how did you know his name would be in there? Like, why did you know that? And it's to get the suspension. And that's exactly how Fincher builds this. And he built it so slowly and so meticulously. It's fantastic. And I think the real suspense from this movie starts from that opening scene where the teenagers get shot.
Yep.
And you think Fincher is going to show you the face of the Zodiac killer. That's what it feels like. It feels like he's coming. You're going to see the face of the Zodiac killer. This infamous serial killer who nobody knows who he is. And if Fincher completely obscures his face so you don't see it.
Yep.
He keeps that mystery going the entire time. And there are four different people who play the Zodiac Killer in this movie.
Are there? They make it so there's different bodies and everything. Four
different actors who play the Zodiac Killer. And that's what Fincher did. And he based it off of all of the accounts of like the descriptions people gave of the Zodiac Killer and how different they were. He took those and he played with them. And he made it so you, as an audience member, had to be so invested in this film just to figure out who could possibly be the Zodiac Killer. And the best part about this movie is you're never told who the Zodiac Killer actually is because no one knows.
Yeah. And that's because we don't know. And it's funny, though, if you do research it, Arthur Allen Lease sure seems like it was him. But anyway, they couldn't ever pin it on him. Now, remember, this movie also came out the year after the Black Dahlia, where the Black Dahlia did say, like, this is who did the killing. The Black Dahlia is not a very good movie. The Black Dahlia is, in fact, like a bad movie. But that movie tried to go there. And Zodiac was just like, no, we're going to do the complete opposite of that. And we're just going to make it very straightforward and whatever. What I love about Zodiac is you sit there and you try to figure it out alongside them. Mm-hmm. That's what the true crime series in general does right now. It lets you try to figure it out with them. The thing I don't like about true crime movies or shows, whatever, is that they ram it down your throat and they just, oh, this is who did it. And by the end of it, everybody's coming out like, oh my God, it was definitely this person. Like, no, it wasn't. That was a documentary made so that it would push you in a direction to feel a certain way. That's all these things are. It really, the one that started that whole thing was the, oh my God, what is the, it was the HBO one where the guy at the end, like confesses to killing people while he's taking a pee. And it's like, okay, then how come they never like really like arrested him? What was his name? Robert something. Anyway, look it up. It was an HBO show. And HBO show, true crime thriller. What the heck was it? The Jinx, that's what it was, with Robert Durst, where it was like, yeah, I killed him and I did this. And it's like, okay, then what's up with Robert Durst? So it just feels like they always try to push you there. This movie doesn't try to push you there. Like, this movie just lets it unfold. And I think part of the excitement, at least from my point of view with this movie, is knowing that they're never going to figure it out, mm-hmm. but still wanting to watch it. Because you have to think, we know that they're not going to figure it out. But when they're living it, they're assuming they're going to figure it out. So Fincher's kind of putting you in alongside them where it's like, oh man, maybe this will be the big break. Maybe this will be the big break. Maybe this is like that false hope, false hope, false hope, false hope, false hope, false hope. It's like watching a movie again or watching Lost again and being like, that person's not going to die this time. And then they die every time. Yeah. That's what Zodiac does. And it puts you in there alongside them because the frustration they feel and the hope that they feel and all of those desire, whatever, we're getting to feel that too. Mm-hmm. And that is such a hard thing to pull off. What Fincher pulls off with Zodiac is so hard to pull off. It's the same thing like when Social Network came out a couple years later, and we're going to talk about Social Network so in depth, mm-hmm. but he turned Harvard into a horror place, yeah. essentially. He turned it into the set of a horror movie. Fincher takes the mundane and makes it so fascinating, except for Curious Case of Benjamin Button when he took something kind of interesting and made it boring as shit. But yeah. Zodiac should be boring. Zodiac should be a bad movie. Yeah. And instead, I sit down and watch Zodiac, and every time I watch it, I'm like, damn. Like, what a confident freaking movie. Like, what a confident movie.
Yeah, it's... Fincher just takes these real people. And, like, every single character in this movie feels real. You know when we get those, like, based on true story movies, we get these, like, over-dramatizations of all these characters? You don't get that in this film. Mm-hmm. Everyone reacts the way you expect a human being to react, which is almost like this subversion of what you expect to happen in the film, because you expect them not to act like a human being mm-hmm. reacts, right? Where, I mean, the one time in the film where someone acts in a completely irrational way is the basement scene.
Yes, and yet I love the basement scene.
It's probably the best scene in the entire film. It's, yeah. one of the most horrifying scenes and suspenseful scenes made in the last 20 years. Yeah. Like, it's so suspenseful. And you sit there, and that's the beauty of the film, right? Mm-hmm. Where, again, that's Fincher playing on us not knowing who the Zodiac Killer is. And despite the fact that there's a lot of evidence that it's this one person, the simple line of, I made all the posters.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Like, it changes everything. All of a sudden, this, like, completely, this scene that's in line with everything else we've seen so far in the movie, just of the investigation, all of a sudden the intensity's ramped up to 10.
Yeah,
all of a sudden there is a sense of danger there, and then you just get, not many people have basements in California.
Yeah, because they had talked about the basement earlier on and we're like, wait, if he has a basement, I mean, it's crazy.
Yeah. And then I had to research why people in California don't have basements. And it's because of earthquakes. And it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. I mean, and you know, like, that's what I'm talking about, though. Like, the basement introduction is such a throwaway early on.
Yeah.
Oh, it's basement. Well, not many people have basements. Oh, okay. And then so much later in the movie. And again, like, Fincher's not constantly bringing it up throughout. Like, the script is just allowed to go where it goes. I mean, The Social Network has one of the greatest scripts of all time, but Aaron Sorkin is very much writing what's going to happen in that. Like, this doesn't feel like we're being set up for payoffs and things like that. Yeah. This just feels like it's unraveling the way it should unravel. And like you said, they act irrationally in that scene, but at the same time, you get that one line and all of a sudden you're that obsessed where it's like, here's a guy who never even came up. What if he is the Zodiac Killer? He's been here. He's been there, whatever. And Jake Gyllenhaal is terrified. Why wouldn't he be terrified? I mean, at that point, like, anything is possible. Anything is possible. And that's the scary part. And that's what Fincher does really well in this is, like, he gives you so many red herrings, but that's all they were following. Now, if you actually look into the case, almost every one of them thinks it was Arthur Lee Allen. Like, almost every single one of them thinks that that's who it was. But he died before they could actually, like, once Magoo actually Gotham, which it's hilarious that it's Jimmy Simpson because if It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. But once he got him, Arthur Lee Allen died and there was nothing they could do. But almost everybody thinks that that's who it was. Toski always says that, like, yeah, it was Arthur Lee Allen.
Yeah.
But you got to think, like, what I think is fun too about this movie, and obviously it's not fun, the fact that it's based on a real story and that it's true and that people actually died and all of that. But what's fun about this is, like, it really shows how technology has created less drama, right? Like, not less drama, but less suspense.
Yeah.
Now you pull out your phone and you're like, ha ha, here's a half edited video of that guy yelling at that guy. And I'm not going to show you what started it, but I'm going to make you angry about it and so that I can get my agenda across. That's what we use technology for. Yeah. But also, if I go for a walk tonight, I'm going to bring my phone with me. And if I see something sketchy, I'm going to call my wife and I'm going to come home. Or I'm going to say, come pick me up, or I'm over here, or she's got my her thing on. And if I don't come home in 20 minutes, she knows where my phone is. Back in the 70s, like, you went out to Lover's Lane like those two people do at the beginning of this movie. Nobody knows where the hell you are.
Yeah.
And there's no way to find you, and there's no way to get in contact with you. And that just creates so much suspense because there is such an isolation. And that's why back in this era, there were so many serial killers because they couldn't track it as easily. If they had the technology that they have nowadays, they probably get the Zodiac killer and know exactly who it is and pin it on them, no problem. But they don't have that technology back then. So they're working with what they have, and they're working with a lot of, well, this is what I think, this is what I think, this is what I think. You got handwriting experts who all are different. They go to different schools of handwriting.
Yeah.
So what the hell does that mean? Like, that just creates such an interesting thing that we just don't see anymore. And you can't really make a serial killer based in modern day and make it as realistic as something like this. You just can't do it.
Yeah. And serial killers are have this really weird place in, like, society. Mm-hmm. And not just because they're, you know, serial killers, but when you see, like, the serial killer boom of the 70s, I guess we can call it, like, the serial killer era that we had there, serial killers became really terrifying. Kind of like when we were talking about, like, Halloween a few weeks ago and stuff like that. Serial killers are scary because they take place in cities, right? Yeah. Like, or on the fringes of cities, right? It's that primeval fear that especially Americans have of, okay, what happens on the fringes of society? And serial killers preyed on that in like this crazy way. It's really weird to think about the impact that these people had on society. The reason why, essentially why, like, stranger danger is a thing and stuff like that, right? Like, these are things that, if you look at, like, European society, like, they don't feel the same way. Uh-huh. About, like, strangers and things like that as Americans do. And it's because of this period of time where there were just all these serial killers running around.
It's a terrifying part
of American history.
The scene in this one where it's like, your tires messed up. This is a guy, I'll fix it for you. Like, okay, thanks. You can't trust anybody. Like, nowadays, it's funny because I was thinking about that. Like, if I'm driving around my town, and it starts downpouring, and I see somebody walking on the side of the road, and I say, hey, do you need a ride? They'd never get in the car. And honestly, I don't know if I'd ever ask somebody to get in my car because who the hell knows what they're doing?
Yeah.
That's the crazy part. And all of that comes from this era, because prior to this era, people weren't fearful of that. Hitchhikers were everywhere. That's why these murders took place so easily, because of hitchhikers and things like that. Like, it's just crazy how this period changed so much in American history. Now, it really, okay, you had the Son of Sam, you had, you know, Ted Bundy, you had the Zodiac Killer. You didn't have that many. You didn't have, like, yeah, any serial killer is a lot of serial killer, but it wasn't like it was every single person that was around you was a serial killer. But the ones you did have were so high profile. And for some reason, there's just this perversion in human mentality to be obsessed with this, to want to know more about it, to be involved with it. It's the same reason why it's, you know, I always love those memes where it's like, oh, girls watching like this. Oh, that's gross. I can't watch that. Girls watching a true crime drama and it's like eating popcorn all excited. Like whatever that meme is, it's like, why do we have such an obsession with that? And why are we so invested in it? And I think a lot of it is that like, what makes a person tick to be this way? Why is Jeffrey Dahmer the way that Jeffrey Dahmer is? And like things like that. And Zodiac, they never could get to the bottom of it because they never found out who the guy was. But the Zodiac killer changed the way people in San Francisco acted.
Yeah.
It's insane.
Yeah, it's the sensationalism of it all, right? Mm-hmm. Where, and we even see it in the opening scene when the cipher first comes. They're like, no, we're not going to do this. Like, it's just going to make things worse. But then they're like, but what if he kills 12 people?
Mm-hmm.
And like, they have to go along with it. And yeah, you see it in the film, how people are reacting to people around there. You see the sensationalism of it. You see like the kid's story where they're describing like four different people as to who got out of this cab.
Yep.
Like it's all these little things that are set up. And then you also have the school bus threat, oh, right? Man, and we see Jake Gyllenhaal's response to it of, okay, kid, you can like keep online with this. And then as soon as it mentions the school bus, it's like, nah, we're turning it off. You're not listening to this.
Yep. And he won't put him on the bus at the one part. And like, You know, that's the thing. Like it's, and we see it still like in American society with school shootings or shootings in malls or shooting in church, wherever the shooting is going to take place. That's kind of become the new serial killer. It's these people who are going to commit mass shootings. And like, it puts this fear, like going to the movie theater. I know people who ever since what happened with The Dark Knight won't go to a movie theater. But what has happened at a movie theater since that Dark Knight incident? Maybe there's been like one shooting, one more. I think there's one more. But at the same time, it's like airplanes.
Yeah.
There's thousands of airplanes that take off every day. You hear about one that crashes. You're not going to hear about another one for years, probably. Mm-hmm. I mean, there hasn't been an American plane crash in what? American commercial plane crash in what, like 20 years almost? Like it's insane.
Yep.
Like that actually killed multiple people. There was that one lady who got sucked out the window on Southwest, but like you're still going to sit on a window on Southwest. But all that's to say, like, it's what this movie really does a good job of showing and depicting is how once it begins, it becomes this culture and it becomes this worry for everybody. The odds are you were never going to run into the Zodiac killer. The end of the day, what do they say? The Zodiac killer killed like seven people or something like that. Yeah. Or they think it was like four or five. And there was a copycat a couple times who just claimed to be the Zodiac killer. But the thing is, San Francisco has how many millions of people? How many millions of people live in San Francisco? And yet everybody was so in fear. And it's that odds and the thoughts and everything like that of, oh, this could happen to me. Yeah, it could, but it is an infinitely small chance that it's actually going to. But Zodiac, this movie, leans into now Jake Gyllenhaal thinks that he's going to get killed by this random guy who's just a film projectionist who didn't do anything.
Yeah.
It leans in so hard. And I think that's why it really works because that's how people felt during this time. They were terrified.
Yeah, and we see the progression through the film too, right? Because even like that second couple who's at the lake, where it's like there's this guy coming towards us, like whatever. And then it's that he has a gun moment.
Yep.
And also, let's like that kill, fantastic. To see him like he has a gun the entire time and then he just stabs them. Beautiful.
Yeah.
No, sick perverted way.
Yeah, well, beautiful and like, wow, how the hell did they get there? And the guys always live because the Zodiac killer was a pervert. And like,
yeah,
it's just crazy.
Yeah, it's so well constructed. And Fincher just took the truth and ran with it. And like, that's one of the things that I find people don't really do with these based on true stories things. They want to fabricate it. They want to Hollywood it. They want to make it more and more spectacular than it actually is. Fincher doesn't do that because he knows that the subject matter he has in this film is enough to keep it going and that the intrigue and the mystery of it is enough to keep it going. He essentially takes what he learned from doing Seven and strings you along this entire movie because you're expecting that, because that's what Fincher's done already. And he delivers something just so much more powerful in this movie that doesn't have a bunch of blood and gore. It doesn't have these obscene murders in it like Seven does. It just has this strong cast of people trying to solve one of the greatest unsolved crimes in American history.
Yeah, it does. And that's a good way to put it. Like, you know, you have an expectation coming in, but like, you know, when you take like a screenwriting class or something like that, they always tell you like, be careful with time and dates and whatever. How many Chirons are in this movie? Chiron, right? How many of those are in this movie where it just says date or time or city or location or how many years later, months later, days later, weeks later, what time it is? It happens all the time. Mm-hmm. They tell you to ease up on those because it can be overwhelming for an audience. You start to be confused. Wait, when is it? When is it? When is it? And yet in this movie, you need them all because it's telling you the story and it wants you to know exactly when it is. Mm-hmm. I think Zodiac does. I think Social Network is better. I probably like Seven more too, even though I talked about how Seven's probably going to drop out of my top 100. But Zodiac is just a great filmmaker in command of his craft, and not for nothing, not even in a less busy year, because he should have been nominated anyway. Robert Downey Jr. gives a he is the best part of this movie. Yeah. He is so good in this movie. Robert Downey Jr. should have gotten a nomination for this. He was never going to win because Javier Bardem was always going to win, but he should have gotten a nomination for this.
Yeah, I mean, we didn't even talk about just the way this film's captured, the way it looks, because Fincher just has such a great way with darkness in his films and just using the most of it. And some of the most terrifying things in Zodiac is what's done in broad daylight.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Yep. I mean, yeah, the lake scene is one of the brightest scenes in the movie.
Yeah.
And two people get brutally stabbed. Yep. Anyway, you want to move on?
Yeah, we should probably keep going.
Alright, what was the best? It's been a couple weeks. What was the best thing you've watched over that time?
Okay, so it's been a couple weeks, and now I had the opportunity to see two movies in my top 100 above where we are now in theaters over the last 2 weeks. I saw both Reservoir Dogs and John Carpenter's The Thing in theaters over the last 2 weeks, and man, those were spectacular things, so they were obviously the best things I watched. But if we're talking about new watches, it was the last time we podcasted, it was right before Canadian Thanksgiving. So I finally took the opportunity to watch Thanksgiving, and boy, oh boy, that is a masterpiece.
That's such a great movie.
It's so good. My roommate's sitting there hating it. He's like, this is absolutely terrible. And it's like, that's why it's so good. This movie is perfection.
That is the best bad movie ever made, in my opinion, because their intention was to make it bad. Like, The Room is iconic, but The Room was meant to be a good movie. Thanksgiving was meant to be bad, and I think people miss that. The scene where they're singing about, like, the turkey, and there's no turkeys up here, Derek, like, whatever. It's brilliant. The scene the scene where he's sitting down with the sheriff's face on, talking to the daughter. And I mean, it's one of the funniest movies you will ever see. And yeah, it was made with like a handheld camera that people can't act. It's terrible. That's the point. It is such a bad movie. It is perfection. I love Thanksgiving.
Yeah, it's wonderful. Watch it this upcoming holiday season, I implore you, because it's so fun. But if we're talking like actual like best movie I saw, I watched 2020's The Empty Man.
Never even heard of it.
Yeah, not many people did, because it came out right as COVID started. So it kind of like faded into obscurity and not many people knew it. It's this very interesting, like, cult horror movie that has a lot of twists and turns and you're not sure where it's going. I was really impressed with this movie. It was a lot of fun. I suggest it for anyone who kind of likes those, like, it's got the, like, investigation aspect of it. It's got the cult aspect to it. It also has this, like, terrifying, like, kind of, like, urban legendy aspect of like a Slenderman-esque figure kind of thing going on about it. I guess like it's kind of Lovecraftian in a way. So it was just, it's surprisingly good, and it really impressed me.
I'll have to check it out. Never even heard of it, but I like James Badge Dale, and I see he's in it, so that always helps. So anyway, I watched a lot of good ones. I've like made it a mission to watch all the Best Picture winners and the Best Picture nominees, like from every year, at least the ones that are available. There's, I think, two or three movies that you literally can't get that were nominated for Best Picture, which will forever bother me, but you just can't get them. So there's nothing I can do, or like they might have like one copy at UCLA. But so I've been watching those. And then I also watched, I've been watching the old Universal horror movies. Like I bought like an 8-pack of those. I don't care what anybody says. Those are some of the most entertaining movies of all time. Mm-hmm. They're cozy. They're homey. It puts you in the mood. Like they're creepy enough. The Dracula, the original Dracula, Bela Lugosi is iconic, but Dwight Frye in that movie gives like one of the creepiest performances ever. And it still holds up to this day. His laugh in that movie bothered me significantly. Watch The Creature from the Black Lagoon, probably my favorite one of the bunch. But I also like, so one of my favorite books is A Tale of Two Cities, which is funny because, John, I was telling you I don't like old timey English, but I love A Tale of Two Cities because the story is just phenomenal. Watch the adaptation of that from 1935. Pretty, like, it's rushed at times, but really well done. But I think the best movie that I watched over this last time was this movie called Dodsworth from 1936. Now, this is a movie I would have never, ever, ever, ever heard of had I not been going through and doing like all of these like Best Picture nominees and everything like that. This was directed by William Wyler, who, like, you know, William Wyler is a pretty big deal. William Wyler did Roman Holiday, Ben-Hur, Best Years of Our Lives. Like, William Wyler's a huge deal. It's got Walter Huston, Paul Lucas, David Niven, like all these like huge names. And it's just a really good movie. Like, it's about a guy who owns this auto company, sells it, and it pushes him into retirement. And now he and his young wife are going to Europe to go on an adventure. And it should feel so dated, but it still feels so relevant. Like, it is so relevant. It's really well made. The acting is phenomenal, which is a lot for 1936. Yeah. There's nobody in this movie who is sitting there overacting. Like, it is so well done. It's a really interesting movie. It's kind of like a better version of Gone with the Wind at this point, because it kind of gives you like that FU moment at the end, but like you don't have to sit through 4 hours of blah, blah, blah. Now, granted, it's not an epic by any means, but it just kind of like has that same like through line of like respecting yourself and coming to terms with your life changing, and it's out of your control and everything in your life being turned upside down. I loved it. I absolutely loved it. I forget what beat it for Best Picture, and now I have to look it up. But I will say that it shouldn't have won. It should have been Dodsworth. And it just makes me laugh that a movie called Dodsworth is what I have to sit here and talk about as my favorite. But it was just really good. It was just a really good movie. If you get a chance, check it out. It's an old one, but it's well worth your time. And now I'm going to look up. Give me 2 seconds, because now I need to find out what it lost to, because otherwise it's going to bother me forever. It lost to The Great Ziegfeld. No, it didn't. It lost to The Life of Emile Zola. Wait. No, it didn't. It lost to The Great Ziegfeld. It should not have lost to The Great Ziegfeld. Even though I like The Great Ziegfeld a lot better than a lot of people do, it should not have lost to that. But anyway, I digress. Okay, we're talking about L.A. Confidential, my movie, 1997. Not my number one from that year, because I do have Good Will Hunting ahead of it. Now, the funny thing,
you have Boogie Nights ahead of it.
You have Boogie Nights ahead of it. 1997 and 1968 are my two favorite years for movies, in case you can't tell. At least top heavy years for movies, because 2001 is probably the best year. But anyway, what's funny with a movie, like when you try to compare LA Confidential, Titanic, Good Will Hunting, and Boogie Nights, right? Like let's just do that very quickly. Those four movies all came out the same year. Boogie Nights wasn't nominated for Best Picture, but it was incredibly popular. Yeah. Boogie Nights, Titanic, LA Confidential, and Good Will Hunting. This is why the Oscars are a stupid concept in the first place. Like, let's be real. Those four movies could not be any more different. And you're going to try to tell me, well, which one's better? Yeah. Well, what the hell do you prefer? Do you want to watch an epic? Do you want to watch a film noir? Do you want to watch a kind of cheesy but awesome movie about like coming of age, or like, and I have it in my top 20. I have no shame in saying that. Or do you want to watch a movie about porn? Like, they're so different. And you have to sit here and it's like picking them apart. LA Confidential, in my opinion, should have been the one that won it, even though I actually have Good Will Hunting and Boogie Nights ahead of LA Confidential. To me, LA Confidential is one of the most perfectly crafted movies in the history of film. Like, in the history of film, it is so perfectly crafted. Good Will Hunting will always hold a special place in my heart, but let's be real. There are so many cheesy moments in Good Will Hunting, so many over-the-top cheesy. But it's such a great movie. You feel for the characters. You love them. But LA Confidential, there's no, well, it's the, no. LA Confidential is pure perfection from beginning to end. The small side stories that all pay off, Mickey Cohen's gang member being shot, Danny DeVito, the role he plays in Sid Hutchins is phenomenal. If Good Will Hunting had not come out the same year as this, everybody would talk about Jack Vincennes. Everybody would talk about it. And they would have found a way to nominate Kevin Spacey for this movie, because Robin Williams obviously just like blew up playing the role that he plays in Good Will Hunting. But Jack Vincennes is amazing. Such a great character. This movie put Guy Pearce and Russell Crowe on the map. They were nobodies when this came out. You had nice old James Cromwell, who was the farmer in Babe. And he comes out and he's one of the biggest pricks in film history. And David Strathairn, Kim Basinger wins the Oscar. The screenplay is second to none. And yet it is a movie that never really gets talked about. People love 90s movies. Silence of the Lambs, Seven, like it's Good Will Hunting, as I said, Boogie Nights. Like, these are movies that people talk about all the time. And they'll even bring up the ones they don't like as much, like The English Patient or A Braveheart, which has suddenly become a little dated, even though I really like Braveheart. But like, they'll talk about the movie, oh, that shouldn't have won, or that shouldn't have done this. I mean, really, the 90s were a time of the epic with Braveheart and you had Titanic and everything like that. But LA Confidential doesn't come up in any of those conversations. And it's such a shame. And we've seen other neo-noirs come out that really don't hit the mainstream as well as they should have. Like, The Nice Guys was an entertaining movie. Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. Like, pretty much anything Shane Black does. But film noir just doesn't really connect with people as much. And it's surprising to me. Like, LA Confidential always shows up. Like, it's on, it's high up on IMDb's top 250. It's in, like, the WGA screenplay thing. Like, it's in all that. But how does this movie not come up more as, like, one of those, like, everyone's – like, The Usual Suspects, everybody's seen it. How is L.A. Confidential not that movie? Because I'll be honest with you, L.A. Confidential might have a better surprise in the movie than The Usual Suspects does. The Usual Suspects is the ultimate ending. But that reveal of James Cromwell with the Rollo Tomasi scene is one of the best scenes ever put on film.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. And I don't know. It's so hard because – you and I both love noir films, but the average person just doesn't. This genre just doesn't hit with people for some reason. And maybe it's because it's like these films of a bygone era that people just don't connect with as much. Maybe it's because of, I don't know, like today, I feel like the film noir kind of doesn't have a place in today's society as much because it's full of stereotypes. It's full of like these negative images that we kind of associate with these bad stereotypes and everything like that. But when they're done correctly, they are just some of the best films ever made. And LA Confidential pulls that off with this ensemble cast that is perfectly established in the first 15 minutes of this movie.
Yeah. And that's the thing. It is an ensemble cast. Like, next week, we're going to talk about The Third Man, which is more of like a normal film noir, right? Like,
yeah.
Like, but the thing with LA Confidential is, when this movie came out, like I said, James Cromwell was coming off of an Oscar nomination for Babe. But at the same time, like, Babe is Babe. Like, it's not like everybody's like, oh, James Cromwell, watch out for this guy. Like, Babe is Babe. Kim Basinger was a nobody. And Guy Pearce and Russell Crowe were unknown. Danny DeVito was obviously a known entity, but he wasn't like a massive star. Yeah. The star was Kevin Spacey. And Kevin Spacey plays the side character in this movie. Never do you think this is Jack Vincennes' movie. But at the same time, they give you all of the characters, but they give you them in doses that lets you know, okay, this is an ensemble. Mm-hmm. When it comes to film noirs, very rarely do you get an ensemble piece for a film noir. Very much you're getting the Sam Spade, I'm going to go figure it out, I got the damsel in distress, blah, blah, blah. That's not what this movie is. And it pits your good guys against each other. But what this movie ultimately is, in my opinion, is just the best ode to the bygone era of Hollywood. Everybody glamorizes the 50s, 60s, 40s era of Hollywood. Like, that is the golden age of how everybody glamorizes it. And we get it so glamorized. And it starts off with the glamour, with that great opening narration from Danny DeVito. And then it's boom, boom, boom. Here's all the dead people with the blood and whatever. And as always, my loyal readers, on the QT and always hush, hush. Like, just brilliant. Because that's what people weren't telling you about Hollywood. And it gets into all of that with the corruption of the police, the way everybody was paying everybody off, how the racism that goes into Hollywood because they're trying to pin it on the three black kids in this movie.
Yeah.
And then the superstardom that goes into it. Jack Vincennes is living the dream, man. He's got a show that's made about him. Everything was great in Hollywood. Like, nothing could go wrong. And yet it gets into that seedy underbelly without having to go to the level of like a Seven, where it's just so gritty and so brutal. It stays very like matter of fact.
Mm-hmm.
The style is just phenomenal. And it just nails everything about that era of Hollywood, down to the fact that Pierce Pratchett is selling girls who look like A-list blonde bombshells. Like, it's just like, it's just so well done. I love every detail of this movie, every single detail.
Yeah, it just has this air to it where it really captures the era so well. It's kind of like how Goodfellas captures that era when we talked about it a couple weeks ago, like how it perfectly sets that era. This does it on the other side of the country, where it's like that, like you said, that opening monologue from Danny DeVito like sets up the glamour and then hits you with that underbelly that's still incredibly present today. Like, if anything, it's more surprising this film hasn't gotten more eyes on it nowadays with the way that the world views, especially the LAPD nowadays.
Yep. Yeah. And you know what I think had a lot to do with it is that Curtis Hanson, who directed it, never lived up to this again. He made 8 Mile a couple of years later, and obviously 8 Mile's popular, but it was Eminem, and that's just going to be popular because it's Eminem. But he never came close. No. I mean, this was his one movie. He never made anything even remotely close to this. And I think that hurts this movie, because when you're going back and you're looking for movies from the 90s or whatever, it was easy to see Good Will Hunting because it was Gus Van Sant. Now, granted, whatever you want to think about Gus Van Sant or not, Gus Van Sant had some hits. And that's going to help. You're going to sit down, you're going to watch, I mean, obviously everybody's going to watch Titanic because it's James Cameron and because it's also like one of the biggest grossing movies of all time. But like Mel Gibson, you're going to have a better chance of watching Braveheart because of Mel Gibson. Yeah. Usual Suspects, you hear about, oh, it's got the twist, whatever. LA Confidential doesn't have anything associated with it like that. And I think that's what hurts it, because not for nothing, Kim Basinger didn't go on to be anything. She gives a great performance in this, wins the Oscar and absolutely deserves it, but she doesn't go on to do anything after this. And with Curtis Hanson going on to do nothing, this is just one of those like forgotten movies. And yet it's just a spot on depiction of LA and every line of dialogue and every plot point. This is one of the best plotted movies of all time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's when I was watching this and they apprehend the three black suspects. And then you get like their escape and everything and their death. And I'm like, we're not even halfway through this movie yet. Yeah. What is happening?
Yep.
And it really lets you buy in because of how it's plotted and how it's set up. And the fact that everything is set up very early in the film for you to be able to piece everything together. And I think a lot of it comes from the fact that like the Night Owl Massacre just seems like this random thing that happened.
Yep.
And it's framed in such a way where it doesn't seem consequential to what we have already seen happen in the film.
Because what they really make the Night Owl Massacre feel like is Edmund Exley's big shining moment to give an FU to everybody. Like, at this point, everybody wants Edmund Exley to fail because he ratted on all the cops. Now, I don't want Edmund Exley to fail, but everybody in the movie wants Edmund Exley to fail because he's a snitch. and they can't believe he'd be a snitch. Well, now he's getting his big moment too, his big hero moment. He comes in and it's a sick 5-person homicide or whatever it is. Like, good. Now he gets that. And that's what it feels like it's going to be, the Night Owl Massacre, whatever. You've already had the bloodbath on Christmas. Now you have the Night Owl Massacre. You have the girls slowly coming in with the nose and everything like that. Russell Crowe clearly doesn't like women who get abused. You have all of these layers. And it's not until the shootout where they kill the three black suspects that all of a sudden this movie completely turns on its head. Because when that happens, it's, oh, slaps on the back, whatever, blah, blah, blah. And then it's like, but something isn't right.
Yeah.
Something is not right. And it's the subtle way that Curtis Hanson portrays this with, oh, you guys already got here and they're holding the shotguns. They're planting the shotguns, but at the moment you're not really thinking about that because you're like, oh, Dudley just sent in his guys early because we know him to do that. We see him let Russell Crowe go in early to save the girl. They talk about that a lot, how he's willing to go in there to screw people over and mess stuff up earlier. And then when it starts to be revealed and you start to see it, and then you go, okay, good. Jack Vincennes is on it. Like, he's changing who he is. He puts the $50 bill down. He doesn't want it anymore. He's not going to get paid off. He's not a crooked cop. Edmund Exley and him are working together. You got Russell Crowe doing it. And then the whole Rollo Tomasi thing happens. And like, that happens with, like, that is the perfect act three turning point. Like, one of the best, because that happens and it changes everything. Everything. And I think that's what's beautiful about LA Confidential. It's 2 hours and 15 minutes, 2 hours, 20 minutes, whatever it is. Every moment matters, but it respects its audience so much that it takes its time to get to the big moments. Yeah. At the beginning of the movie, you watch so much happen. You're like, why does any of this matter? All of it comes back. Bud White's partner and all that stuff. Whatever the guy's, I can never remember what his name is, but whatever the guy who, the cop who, not Dick Stenzel, the guy who ends up underneath, Buzz Meeks. Like, Buzz Meeks gets introduced. I'm an ex-cop, whatever. Like, all of those little things. And then you have Pierce Patchett and Lynn Bracken kind of running everything. Yep. And Sid Hudgens just spinning his web. It lets you just go along for the ride. Mm-hmm. And going along for the ride with a movie like this is 95% of the fun.
Yeah. And it sets it, like I said, it sets it up so early because, like, even when we first are introduced to Exley and, like, he's talking about how he wants to be detective, mm-hmm. and Dudley is apprehensive to it. It's because Dudley doesn't want him there because he knows he's straight now and he knows he's not going to be able to control him. But you don't mm-hmm. figure that out until you're 75% of the way through this movie.
Yeah. And you then, think, like, that Dudley's more trying to, like, hey, you don't want to do this because it's not going to be good for you. Not, I don't want you to do this because you're going to mess up what I have going on with all the detectives here.
Yeah. And it's proven throughout the movie because Exley is able to make Russell Crowe's character turn in the end. Like, mm-hmm. he makes him turn on Dudley at the end because he didn't actually know he was doing Dudley's thing. But that's how the genius of Dudley as a villain in this movie is that he's one of those, like, mastermind villains where mm-hmm. he can manipulate everyone to do things in ways where he doesn't even seem like he's doing it until you really dive into it.
Well, and the way that James Cromwell plays the role and the fact that they had mm-hmm. it be James Cromwell, an older guy who, you know, he was 57 at the time. He's got, like, that, I'm older, I'm wise, and, like, I take care of my own. But he's also taking care of everybody else by killing them or taking their money or whatever. Like, he's just such a crooked cop, but you don't really see it coming. He, the way that he's portrayed, he feels more like he's the soul of the movie. Like, he's mm-hmm. the heart. He's where people are going to feel comfortable.
Yeah.
He's helping out his people. He's got their back. That ain't what he is at all, but that's how he portrays it. Like, he's got your best interest in mind. He doesn't want him to become detective lieutenant because you don't have what it takes to do this. And that's not really what he's saying. you know, he wants people he can control and that he has, he can manipulate. Bud White's a great cop, but Bud White can't think. Great. That's what I want, because Bud White will do whatever I ask him to do. I can push his buttons easily, and he does it the whole time. Edmund Exley, he can't do that with. And that's what bothers him. But then again, that's what makes this movie so great, is you have such distinct characterization of all of these cops, and they always act the way that they should act. None of these characters make a decision based on, okay, that's going to benefit the movie. Like Edmund actually not wearing his glasses when he goes out is amazing, because it's that pride. It's that even though he acts like he's better, he still wants to belong. He wants to be accepted. And he has so much pride that he won't wear his glasses when he goes out. Like, and then he can't see what the hell he's doing. It's great. It's great. The characterization is just top notch.
It's not the best characterization we've ever seen in this type of film, because we don't fall into these stereotypical characters at the same time. Like, despite the... It's very important that the three characters we follow in Exley, White, and Vincennes are not crooked cops.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they...
Well, Vincennes is a crooked cop,
well,
but...
He walks the line, but it's a different type of crooked. It's not like the other crooked cops.
Mm-hmm.
Right? He's not out there murdering people and stuff. But yeah. It's so...
Okay, I totally lost you, John. Totally lost you. I don't know if that's John or if that's me, but I totally 100% lost John. I'm going to assume it's John who's frozen, and I'm going to keep talking. He was talking about, well, now I don't know, but he is totally frozen, I think. So anyway, yeah, LA Confidential for me, it's just like, yeah, Jack Vincennes, he toes that line. It's pretty wild to me that Jack Vincennes, that Kevin Spacey doesn't get a nomination for this movie, especially when you look at who was nominated that year. I mean, Burt Reynolds, Greg Kinnear for As Good As It Gets. As Good As It Gets is a very popular movie. Anthony Hopkins for Amistad, which Anthony Hopkins was really at like the height of everything. You're back, John. You completely froze when you were talking about Jack Vincennes. Now I'm just talking about him. I can't believe he wasn't nominated. But it was Brian Helgeland and Curtis Hanson who wrote the script for this one.
Mm-hmm.
Brian Helgeland also went on to write Mystic River, which is a fantastic adaptation. And it was James Ellroy who wrote this book. He also wrote The Black Dahlia. And, you know, like that was like his other kind of big one. But L.A. Confidential was his money one. But Brian Helgeland went on to do Mystic River, and he didn't really do much else after that either. But anyway, what was your point, John? Where were you? Do you remember?
I was just talking about how each of these three protagonists are so distinctly their own character, and they fall into these like very specific archetypes, but they don't fall into cliche archetypes.
Mm-hmm.
And like that's the big thing that this film does, is it balances that aspect of it, where yeah, we have the corrupt cops, the ones who are really crooked and really like getting in on it all the time. But we have these three protagonists who feel more real because they're surrounded by these more over the top characters.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I mean, like Pierce and, but what, when you're saying over the top characters, like Dick Stensland, Buzz Meeks, those are over the top characters.
Yeah.
But like a character like Pierce Patchett is so well done in this movie. And it always mm-hmm. helps when you have David Strathairn playing the role, because David Strathairn's a great actor who just always was bits until he did Good Night and Good Luck. But I like that character could have been so much more over the top. That could have been an abusive guy, whatever. He's a businessman. He's a businessman. He does everything by the book. Like he is trying to provide a service that works. He doesn't hit the girls or anything. Like Kim Basinger gives him like a standing ovation pretty much when she's talking about him. And same thing with Lynn Bracken. She could be such an over the top femme fatale. Lynn Bracken is a very subdued female character for this type of movie. And I think that's why she ended up winning the Oscar, because it was a different, like this wasn't Barbara Stanwyck. Like this was something totally different than that. And it's funny that she plays Veronica Lake, considering, I don't know, go look up Veronica Lake's story. It's very depressing. But yeah, now you know. But like, Lynn Bracken's story is a depressing story. Yeah. And but we also see it to the Simon Baker extent in this movie, which it's funny that he's Simon Baker something in this movie when he goes on to be the mentalist and like actually became pretty famous. But we see him going out there to be an actor and everything, and he ends up dying. And Kevin, that's when Kevin Spacey has his change of heart. Like all of these characters, they could be caricatures. And yes, they're over the top. Like it's an over the top reality. But they remain within the reality. Like Sid Hutchins is probably the most outrageous character in this movie. And yet at that, like Danny DeVito plays it perfect because at that time, like that's a character that totally existed.
Yeah. And I mean, it's a character that probably only Danny DeVito could really do too.
Yeah, that's true.
Like Danny DeVito has this special air about him, and him playing Sid Hutchins, it just feels very Danny DeVito.
Mm-hmm.
But it also feels like it fits so well into the universe of the film.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Maybe Danny DeVito just is like this remnants of 1950s LA still.
Well, and Danny DeVito, you know, and I mean this with love, but Danny DeVito's just got like a sleazebag thing to him. Like that's why he's so funny and Frank. Yeah. He's so funny as Frank and is always sitting in Philadelphia because he's such a sleaze. And that's what he is in this movie. Like he's such a scumbag, but you can't help but watch it. And even at the part where like you find out he's going to get killed, he's like, come on, man. Well, I thought you were going to let him beat the crap out. Like he's in on it. He's in on everything. He's got his finger in everything. He's getting paid everywhere. But that's how he makes his living and it works for him.
Yeah. It's so fun. And like sometimes we just forget movies can be fun.
Yeah.
And still be like well crafted films. And that's what LA Confidential is. It's a fun film that's keeps you pulled into it the entire time. Like you're always engaged with what's happening because you're trying to figure out what's going on just as much as the characters in the film. It has that air of mystery to it the entire time. And then even when you get the reveal, there's still a mystery of, okay, how are our protagonists going to overcome this? Because we just watched one of them die.
Yeah. Well, and I think that this movie does some of the best character development of any movie ever. Because Jack Vincennes doesn't talk to anybody about what he's going through. It's all emotion. And like that just goes back to what a great actor Kevin Spacey was. Like, he really was just, in the 90s, we were talking about this, Usual Suspects, Seven, this, American Beauty, did all those movies in 5 years.
Yeah.
I mean, it's unbelievable. He was so good in this movie. And the way he moves and his facial expressions and his body language, that's what's telling you he's changing. Edmund Exley, he never tells anybody that he's willing to kill James Cromwell because he doesn't realize he's willing to kill him until he actually pulls the trigger. But it all goes back to those questions that he's asked by Dudley at the beginning. Could you possibly do this? Could you possibly shoot a man because you know that he'd probably go free? And then it's a no. But by the end of the movie, after everything he goes through, it's finally a yes. Bud White goes from the bull in a china shop to I'm getting out of this. Like I finally have found a place to settle. Like the character development is unbelievable. And these arcs are just fantastic. And they're subtle throughout the entire time rather than being some like grandiose thing. And that, you know, that's what I like about this movie because these movies could be a lot different. I love also the way though that it weaves in all of the real stuff, the Mickey Cohen stuff and all that. Like I love the reality that is weaved into the fictional storyline. I love the ending of the movie where we do see Edmund actually make the decision to kill Dudley. The Rollo Tomasi reveal is one of the best reveals ever. I mean, it's such a simple, why do you do Rollo Tomasi? He's the guy who got away. And when Kevin Spacey says Rollo Tomasi to him, and it's the next scene. I mean, they don't waste any time. It's the next scene comes out. Hey, somebody was following up with Rollo Tomasi. It is perfect delivery. It is. I know everything about. I know you killed him now, and there's nothing you can do to prove otherwise. There's nothing. Yeah. I know you killed him. It's brilliant. It's just brilliant.
Yeah, and Guy Pearce plays that scene so well. Yeah. His facial expression there is incredible. I think Guy Pearce has always kind of been one of those like really underrated actors for me.
Very underrated.
Where when he's in a film and he's given his all, he is a very good actor.
Yeah. Yeah. He is. I mean, I had a Memento earlier. I mean, he's got a movie called The Proposition, which is definitely worth a watch if you haven't seen it. He's even good in like The Count of Monte Cristo, even though that movie's kind of like over the top. But like Guy Pearce is a very good actor. It's just like, I don't know why he didn't become bigger than he was. I really don't. Like, I don't understand what it was. Like, because he can act. Mm-hmm. I don't know. But anyway. But yeah, that's what I have with this movie. I mean, this is my number two film noir. Because I have Chinatown up there at number 14. But like, it's funny how the similarities between this movie and Chinatown, and we'll talk about Chinatown in a couple weeks now, but the similarities between these two movies and how they both are an ode to that bygone era of Los Angeles and Chinatown. J.J. Geddes is in every single scene of the movie, which sounds like, oh, okay, who cares? That almost never happens in a movie. He's in every single scene. That almost never happens. And L.A. Confidential is kind of like a mosaic. Like it's, mm-hmm. it's all over. Like, it's so interesting to see how you can do it two totally different ways and still make it totally work. But yeah, the problem with a movie like LA Confidential, when it came to the Oscars and everything, it lost everything to Titanic with the excitement, because Jerry Goldsmith's score in this is also fantastic. Really brings you back to that era. It lost everything to Titanic except for adapted screenplay and supporting actress. But like, who were you going to nominate for supporting actor? Like, I keep going back to Kevin Spacey, but DeVito is perfect. James Cromwell is perfect. Guy Pearce is perfect. Russell, like, who are you going to nominate? Who are you gonna, there's too many.
Yeah.
There's too many. It's just a phenomenal movie. And yeah, I mean, Russell Crowe and Guy Pearce, like, it's so hard to remember. Like, when you watch the Rollo Tomasi scene, for anybody who's listening to this who hasn't seen this in a while or wants to go back and watch it, remember Guy Pearce and Russell Crowe were not famous yet. They're not the Guy Pearce and Russell Crowe we know now. And Kevin Spacey was at the height of his career.
Yeah.
So when Kevin Spacey got shot, that was one of the most shocking moments of that year. More shocking than the guy jumping off the boat and hitting the propeller in Titanic. Like, that was just shocking. And yeah, I mean, that's all I got about that. Like, you need to be able to put yourself in that mindset of 1997, not 2022.
Yeah.
But that's all I got. I'll let John go watch Survivor now. He's allowed.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate it.
So anyway, we'll be back. We'll be back again next week. We got The Third Man for John. These are our number 22 movies of all time. Third Man for John from 1949. And I got Blue Valentine from 2010. Can't wait to discuss that. Blue Valentine is rated NC-17. Really can't wait to dive into that one. And The Third Man is just a really, really interesting film noir to watch. So those will be fun.
I really hope you guys are ready for some zither, because we're going to talk a lot about it.
There you go. That's all we needed to hear, John. But thank you everybody for listening. Become patrons, patreon.com/survivorspecialist. We talk about movie buffs. Nobody ever talks about movie buffs on our Discord, but if people start listening, then they'll start talking about it, right? Like if they join, it'll be a conversation. So go ahead, jump over there. Otherwise, we'll see you all after Halloween. So go watch some spooky movies, enjoy yourselves, and we'll see you next week.